Is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandi Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, How to Break an Abusive Trauma Bond. If you've ever been involved in a toxic relationship that you can't or don't want to break free from, or if you've watched a loved one suffer in one and wondered, why don't they just leave, you may find that the concept of trauma bonding explains a lot. A trauma bond is a deep emotional attachment that develops in a relationship characterized by abuse that's emotional, physical, or both. In this lopsided power dynamic, the abuser maintains control through a variety of tactics that ultimately make the abused person believe that ending the relationship is a terrifying or even impossible prospect. Exploitive relationships create trauma bonds. These occur when a victim bonds with someone who is destructive to them, wrote Patrick J. Carnes, Ph.D., founder of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals, who define the term as mental health professionals know it today. To be loyal to that which does not work, or worse, to a person who is toxic, exploitive, or destructive to the client, is a form of insanity. While it may be irrational, falling prey to a trauma bond definitely doesn't mean that you're weak, says Terry Cole, therapist and author of Boundary Boss. A lot of times, at least in my practice, the women in trauma-bonded experiences were highly capable, and this was something embarrassing and humiliating. So it's doubly isolating when you don't identify as someone who needs help in any other part of your life. Here, experts share signs of trauma bonding and tips on how to cope, as well as how to finally break a trauma bond for good. Trauma bonding can happen between a parent and child. While trauma-bonded romances can be particularly intoxicating because of the sexual aspect, it can happen in all relationships, says New York-based therapist Imani Wilform, MHCLP. Families, friends, cults. Stockholm syndrome is a type of trauma bond too, Wilform says. In the days of U.S. slavery, there was sometimes trauma bonding between enslaved people and their masters, she adds. Even some who were free didn't know how to truly escape because this was their narrative. The signs can sneak up on you. We hear about it all the time with narcissists, but the nature of a trauma bond is usually that it's fast and furious, Cole says. In romances, it begins with an intense attraction and love bombing. More on that below. Regardless of whether a trauma-bonded relationship is romantic in nature, Cole and Wilform both point to common red flags to watch out for. The abusive person might outwardly seem very charming, veer unpredictably between emotions, blame you for their shifting moods, find ways to isolate you from friends and family, and fail to follow through on promises, including vows to treat you better. You might find yourself making excuses to minimize or deny things the abuser does, using mood-altering substances to cope, such as alcohol, growing numb to the emotional or physical abuse, effectively normalizing it, changing behavior to avoid setting off the abuser, or lying to loved ones about aspects of your relationship. Beware of love bombing. In a trauma bond, there's abuse, devaluation, and then positive reinforcement. But of course, it doesn't start that way, Cole says. At first, she explains, the abuser usually employs a manipulation tactic known as love bombing, overwhelming you with gifts, excessive praise, and/or constant communication. They may even call you their soulmate early on, planting the belief that your connection is fated. It feels so good, and now your brain is flowing out oxytocin, the bonding hormone, Cole continues. But once that initial love bonding phase is over, the devaluing begins. From then on, the person who's had the script flipped on them is always seeking the initial high, trying to get back to when things were amazing. This reward-punishment-reward cycle of abuse recurs with slight variations, cementing the trauma bond. Often, she says, there's this dysfunctional attempt at repair where the other person will apologize, shower love and praise, say they won't ever do it again, and so it begins again. If you're wondering whether it's love or trauma bonding, Wolfram and Cole agree that if you have to ask, it's likely love has very little to do with your situation. And the fact is, a trauma bond will not transform into a healthy relationship, no matter how much the person being abused hopes so or tries to fix it. It's often mistaken for love, Wolfram says, but love doesn't consist of you having to be in a cycle of being mentally diminished or physically hurt. Cole asks clients, if someone you loved was in this situation, would you want them to experience the kind of relationship you're in right now? If the answer is no, that's revealing something. It's not as easy as just break up. It can be hard to understand why someone would just accept the trauma bond as their reality, regardless of how terrible things get. Usually, a person in a trauma-bonded situation is unhappy, Cole says. They may not even like their person anymore, but they still can't seem to actually end things. Keeping the darker parts of the bond secret from loved ones further minimizes it in their own minds too, she adds, and the selective memory of good times stokes the belief that it's a livable situation that might improve. It will not. Fear also plays a larger role in why they can't. In a physically abusive situation, they may legitimately fear for their life. Additionally, says Cole, if you identify this experience as love, it would be the same fear that you would have of losing your love. Intellectually, it makes no sense. Love and pain don't have to go together, but for people who are trauma bonded, they do. You can break a trauma bond with help. Breaking the cycle of a trauma bond is extremely difficult and requires a multi-pronged action plan. The bottom line is that you have to really want to, says Cole. I've known clients who do this dance of breaking apart and coming together again. Make a safe exit plan. Prioritize your safety first, which includes making a safe plan for how to leave and where you are going. Execute that plan the minute you can financially afford to. Don't tell anybody except one close friend, Cole says. Sharing your plan with your abuser is a dangerous risk, and the impulse to do so is a sign you're not quite prepared to leave. If someone can really do this and keep it to themselves, I always see that as a sign of readiness. Break your silence. Open up to trusted, non-judgmental loved ones who understand that you're in a bad situation. The abuser may try to contact them through a family member or mutual friend, Wolfram warns. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is another excellent resource, and Wolfram stresses that the hotline isn't just for those who aren't being physically abused. It's important to clear your browser and call history after reaching out if you have reason to suspect your communications are being monitored. Make an okay and not okay list. Identify how your next relationship will be different by looking back at what you won't allow again. When you use denial as a psychological defense to not take action, it's really important that we see in black and white what's actually happening, Cole says, so that your mind can't keep going back to when it was good 12 years ago. No contact is the rule, period. If you're co-parenting, Cole says to involve a therapist, social worker, or mediator to put boundaries in place. In that one exception, you may have to communicate through email, but you have to block this person. Even a little contact is poison. Figure out what drew you to this dynamic. No contact is one of the ultimate goals, but you also have to find yourself again, Wolfram says. Work on rebuilding your eroded self-esteem. Your next chapter requires learning the answers to questions like, what drew you to this relationship? What am I not going to accept in the next relationship? How can I set boundaries moving forward? This work is crucial because Wolfram says that whether they realize it or not, the abuser has prepared the abused person to perpetuate this and potentially become an abuser as well. If they don't seek professional help, it's just going to be a generational cycle. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled The Real Story Behind Hollywood's Gas Station That Serviced A-Listers. Ryan Murphy's Netflix drama Hollywood is a dream for those obsessed with the golden era of Tinseltown. It's sure to set you on a Googling frenzy, searching for details of the tortured lives of stars like Rock Hudson, Anna Mae Wong, and Hattie McDaniel. But what may be one of the most intriguing pieces of history the show unearths is an unassuming gas station that served as an underground hookup spot. And we're introduced to it in the very first episode when a naive, broke Jack, played by David Corenswet, is recruited by Ernie, played by Dylan McDermott, to work as a station attendant who also doubles as an escort for the Hollywood elite. And as we were surprised to find out, this storyline isn't some fictional scenario cooked up by Murphy. Hollywood's Ernie is inspired by a very real man named Scotty Bowers, who died at the age of 96 in October 2019. And yes, he did in fact create a network of gas station sex workers in the 1940s. Dylan McDermott's Ernie is based on the real-life Scotty Bowers. Amidst the release of his 2012 tell-all book, Full Service, My Adventures in Hollywood and the Secret Sex Lives of the Stars, Bowers revealed himself to be one of the post-war Hollywood's biggest facilitators of sexual trysts for A-listers. Labeled male madam to the stars, a sex fixer, and a go-to hookup provider, his services were an open secret amongst the acting elite, specifically for closeted gay, lesbian, and bisexual stars. There's even a 2017 documentary about his story called Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood, directed by Matt Treinauer. And as it's shown in Hollywood, Bowers claims that Rock Hudson was one of his frequent customers. He was a gentleman fixer for generations of people in Hollywood who were forced by the morals clauses in studio contracts to live double lives, Treinauer told the New York Times, and to hide their true identities in order to conform to what Gore Vidal, a close friend of Scotty's, called the heterosexual dictatorship. In order to prepare for the role of Bowers, McDermott turned to the doc. He tells OprahMag.com, "The documentary really helped me in terms of Scotty's internal world, so I used some of that. And I used the muse of Clark Gable. So it was kind of put it all in a big soup and then Ernie comes out." McDermott adds, "I know if Scotty were alive, he would absolutely love this show. I think he would just marvel at it and get a good laugh." Okay, so is the Hollywood gas station real too? If you can believe it and take Bowers' word for it, yes. After he served in the Marine Corps during World War II, at 23 years old, Bowers moved to L.A. and quickly found a job as an attendant at the Richfield Oil gas station in 1946. According to the Hollywood Reporter, the station, which is now a fire station, was located at the corner of Van Ness Avenue at 5777 Hollywood Boulevard. It was there where he said he met Oscar-winning actor Walter Pidgeon while pumping his gas. Pidgeon invited him to his home, and that was the beginning of a brief affair. As they say, the rest was history. From there, Pidgeon spread news around town of the services, and more stars would show up to the station looking for what Bowers called his sexual matchmaking. To keep up with the demand, according to THR, he soon employed a steady network of male and female sex workers. And as shown in Hollywood, there was in fact a trailer located on the property as an option for clients. "My operation, if you want to call it that, was not a prostitution ring," Bowers wrote in his book, according to the New York Times. "I was simply providing a service to those who wanted it, and as recorded history has shown, throughout the ages, there has always been a need for good, old-fashioned, high-quality sex." He worked the gas station until 1950 and then became a handyman and bartender for hire at Hollywood's most exclusive events. This allowed him to develop more up-close and personal relationships with celebrities, earning their trust for services that were very much a secret at the time. However, Bowers says that his work ended in the 1980s during the height of the AIDS epidemic. In his books, he wrote, "It was too unsafe a game to play anymore." So, which celebrities did Bowers reportedly service? In addition to arranging liaisons for Rock Hudson, who lived as a closeted gay man until he died of AIDS in 1985, Bowers claims to have both slept with and arranged hookups with the era's biggest names. He alleges that his clients included Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy, Cole Porter, Vivian Leigh, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Betty Davis, and Katharine Hepburn, for whom he said he arranged more than 100 trysts with women. So what does Bowers think of airing these late celebs' history? I've kept silent all these years because I didn't want to hurt any of these people, Bowers told the New York Times in 2012. And I never saw the fascination. So they like sex how they liked it. Who cares? If you want to learn more about Bowers' eventful life, check out his book, which you can find on Amazon. You can also watch Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood on Amazon Prime, YouTube, or Hulu. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, J.Lo Thanked Her Kids for Showing Her the True Meaning of Love. All Jennifer Lopez superfans know this fact. The singer, dancer, movie star, from Hustlers to Selena, workout champion, and all-around modern Renaissance woman calls her kids the Coconuts. Technically, the 13-year-old twins' names are Emmy and Maximilian, or Max, Muniz. But in interviews and on Instagram, Lopez frequently refers to them by the name of the tropical fruit. Speaking to Jay Leno on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, Lopez explained the nickname's origin story goes all the way back to the infant years. When they were little and in their cribs and they started growing hair, they looked like coconuts. It just stuck, she said. In the same interview, Lopez said she was once given a necklace with two coconuts engraved with the twins' initials as a Christmas present. She can put the coconut necklace in her jewelry box next to the custom necklace Ben Affleck gave her upon getting back together, almost 20 years after they called off their engagement in September 2003. Lopez wore the necklace in the series of photos she posted on her 52nd birthday, which functioned as their official Instagram debut. Lopez was also spotted with a charm necklace with the letters B-E-N. Clearly, necklaces hold sentimental significance for J-Lo. With Affleck and Lopez's reunion seemingly going strong, Lopez soon may have more kids in her life. She and her ex-fiancé Alex Rodriguez blended their families. Affleck has three children with his ex-wife, Jennifer Garner, daughters Violet and Serafina, and son Samuel. Here's what you need to know about Lopez's kids, whom Lopez credits for teaching her the true meaning of love. J.Lo realized she was pregnant while on tour. According to a video on her YouTube page, Lopez learned she was pregnant while on tour in Portugal. I felt a flutter. I felt a little butterfly in my stomach. I immediately knew I had life inside me. I knew it, Lopez told her kids. What she couldn't predict was that she was having twins. I just laughed out loud. I couldn't believe it, she said. Their twins' full names contain references to their ancestors. The twins' middle names are David and Maribel. David is a reference to Lopez's father, David Lopez. Maribel was the name of Anthony's sister who died of brain cancer when she was 9, per People. As for the significance of the twins' first names, Lopez hasn't opened up about why she chose Emmy and Maximilian, but it could have to do with her name. Emmy is a variant of the English name Emma and means universal. Max is a Latin name that means greatest. Emmy and Max's dad is music legend Mark Anthony. Lopez and Mark Anthony were married from 2004 to 2014. Though they split up, Anthony is still present in his kids' lives. On Instagram, Anthony posted a photo of him and Lopez walking with Emmy between them. He captioned the photo, "Nothing but love between us." They celebrated their 13th birthday in February. Emmy and Max were born on February 22, 2008, which means they officially entered the teen years in 2021. To commemorate the occasion, Lopez posted a video of their birthday morning. She served them breakfast in bed and wrote them notes, which they didn't read out loud, but they seemed pleased. "My beautiful babies are teenagers today," she captioned the clip. "I can't believe it's been 13 years since I carried them both home in my arms in the middle of a snowstorm. Out of that blizzard came two perfect little coconuts who rearranged my life and taught me the true meaning of love. I'm feeling so many emotions this morning, so proud and happy and heartbroken that I can't freeze time," she said. The twins' birthday is practically a high holy day for Lopez's family. Without fail, Lopez shares a social media tribute in honor of the occasion. On their 8th birthday, for example, she posted a picture of them blowing out the candles. "You have brought me nothing but joy and happiness since the very second you were born. I am so proud of who you are and the beautiful, loving, caring people you are growing into," she wrote. Emmy performed at the Super Bowl with her mom. Shakira and J-Lo's Super Bowl performance was full of headline-worthy moments, and Emmy's appearance was one of them. At the age of 11, Emmy took the stage before 62,000 people and many more fans watching at home to sing "Let's Get Loud" alongside her mom. The Super Bowl was scary at first, thinking about it, but while it was happening, it was all really nice, Emmy told Access Hollywood's Mario Lopez. Speaking to Hoda Kotb on Today, Lopez said she nailed it. Clearly, Emmy has the chops, but Emmy doesn't necessarily want to follow in her parents' footsteps and become a performing artist. Emmy told ET's Mario Lopez she doesn't plan to become a professional singer, but will always sing as a hobby. And Emmy published her first book, Lord Help Me, at the age of 12. In 2020, Emmy published a book of her favorite prayers entitled Lord Help Me, Inspiring Prayers for Every Day. Emmy said she inherited her sense of spirituality from her family. "It first came from my mom and my grandma and my aunts. My grandma's very religious. I used to see her a lot. So whenever I saw her, we always prayed together. We prayed at dinner, we prayed before we went to bed," she told Refinery29. As the book shows, Emmy prays throughout the day. She frequently prays for her mom, too. "I usually pray before she does her shows and stuff because she can get hurt in many ways," she told Today. For more pictures of the kids now, check out J-Lo's Instagram. J-Lo is more than happy to share her kids with the world. The proud mama is always posting pictures and videos on her Instagram page. This much is clear. Lopez loves spending time with her coconuts. Our next article by Gretchen Rubin is titled, "Considering a Major Life or Career Change? This Could Help You Make the Right Decision." Chances are you or someone you know has considered or perhaps even made a major life change in the past year and a half. Maybe you're thinking about leaving your tiny city apartment for a more spacious home in the suburbs. Or perhaps you're mulling over the idea of quitting your job without any set plans. Or you could be contemplating whether your long-term relationship has run its course. Whatever big life decision you're considering, you're not alone. The U.S. Postal Service processed nearly 36 million change of address requests last year, while home sales in 2020 hit the highest level since 2006, according to the National Association of Realtors. Meanwhile, a record-breaking 4 million people quit their jobs in April of 2021, a number that has remained nearly as high every month since then, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Not to mention that in the 2020 edition of Match's annual Singles in America report, more than half of respondents said they're prioritizing dating, while jewelers have described double-digit increases in engagement ring sales, as reported by the Washington Post. With that in mind, we pose the following question to readers on Facebook and Instagram. Are you in the midst of making a big change? If so, what is causing you the most anxiety and why? Unsurprisingly, it generated a lot of responses, so many, in fact, that I'll be answering a few more in the next installment of this column, with many expressing concern over a significant change at work. I heard from people who were switching career paths, retiring or considering retirement, launching their own businesses, going back to school after decades in the workforce, reducing or expanding their hours, and more. We make life-altering decisions all the time, of course, but the extraordinary disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic appear to have prompted many people to step back and ask themselves big questions. Am I doing what I want to be doing? Am I spending my time in a way that's fulfilling? That's to be expected. Studies have shown that natural disasters and other traumatic events can spur people to make big changes as a result of seismic shifts in how we think and relate to the world. While the pandemic has brought tremendous suffering and hardship, it has also offered different possibilities. For some, enhanced unemployment benefits mean the opportunity to look for different work. Others are embracing work life with more flexibility, less time on the road, and more time spent in yoga pants. And others are finally acknowledging a big dream that had been pushed aside in the tumult of everyday life. Ahead, I've addressed three of the most common work-related changes and concerns we've received from readers to date. I'm starting a new job after 18 years. Will it begin with a bang or epic fail? Tracy D. Trujillo from Palm Desert, California. Congratulations! Starting a new job is exciting, of course, but it can also seem intimidating. In fact, nearly 80% of working professionals experience nerves when starting a new job, according to a LinkedIn survey. For starters, there are so many new names, faces, procedures, and programs to learn, as well as so much new information to absorb, all of which, thanks to the pandemic, might be happening strictly through video and conference calls. As you jump into your new position, beware of setting up a false deadline that suggests that from the start, you'll either be a big success or a big failure. And beware of setting up a false choice that suggests that if you're not a big success, you're an epic fail. The reality is that when we start a new job, we have a period of learning when we're figuring things out. If you set unrealistically high expectations for yourself at the beginning, you'll likely feel even greater discouragement by the natural challenges of starting a new position. So instead of worrying about everything you don't know, focus on arriving with plenty of thoughtful questions instead. That could include, what does success look like in my role? What should I be able to do by the end of the first month, 3 months, 6 months? What's the usual process for this? Not only will this indicate to your new boss that you're prepared and proactive about learning new skills and systems, but it'll also help you feel like you have a greater understanding of your new workplace. And when you make a mistake, and that will happen, take the time to examine what went wrong and how you can ensure you get it right the next time. Equally important, get to know the people around you. Not only will work friendships help you better understand the company culture and potentially improve job performance, but it'll also make work more enjoyable. If you're on the shy side, ask your boss to introduce you to the people you'll work with more closely, then offer to take a walk together or buy them a cup of coffee to get to know them better. And maybe it's just me, but I find that every time I start a new job, I'm absolutely exhausted for the first few weeks. I remember telling a friend, this new job is so tiring that I'm going to have to start going to bed at 8 p.m. every night. These days, we're all dealing with a lot of uncertainty and disruption, even if we haven't switched jobs. So make sure to find some time for yourself, whether that's taking a 30-minute walk, reading a captivating new book, catching up on your favorite TV show, whipping up a trusty comfort food, or working on a challenging jigsaw puzzle. I'm going back to school and I'm almost 40. I ask myself, what was I thinking at least once a day? Bethany Jones from Boston, Massachusetts. Even if it doesn't always feel like it, which by the way is normal, the truth is you're taking an exciting step. In fact, while you may be questioning your decision to return to school, research suggests that more people regret what they didn't do than what they did do, even if those decisions didn't turn out well. Not to mention that people regret not taking the steps that would allow them to live up to their full potential. Instead of thinking about all the things that could go wrong, try and focus on what motivated you to go back to school in the first place. To do so, write down three reasons why you wanted to return to school. For example, you'll be better able to advance in your job, you'll finally be able to pursue a new passion, or you'll be in a deeply stimulating environment, and place that list in a spot where you'll see it daily. Think next to your bathroom mirror, on your refrigerator, or even on your bedside table. Not only will this motivate you to continuously keep moving forward, but it'll also help keep things in perspective on days when you're feeling particularly unsure, anxious, or discouraged. You can also take heart in the following. 40% of college students are 25 or older, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, and studies have shown that adult learners tend to be happier and more successful than their younger counterparts. That's likely a result of the skills, experience, and sense of responsibility that you've developed through years of personal and professional development. And of course, keep in mind that even if you're feeling some doubt now, in the future it's very likely that you'll be happy that you pushed yourself to take this big step. I'm anxious about leaving the career path that I feel I'm supposed to be on in order to start my own business. Leah Penrose from Richmond, British Columbia. Congratulations, you're pursuing a big dream. Several years ago, hospice nurse Bronnie Ware posted about the 5 most frequent regrets that people shared at the end of their lives. The most common regret? I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. So when faced with a difficult decision, there are a few key questions I often ask myself. Does this decision help me to follow my personal commandment to be Gretchen? Of course, everyone should substitute their own names. When I contemplate a particular course of action, do I feel energized or drained? Is a particular course of action that allows me to expect more from myself, meaning it's scary in a positive way, one that will allow me to grow, or does this course of action mean I'm not accepting myself, meaning it feels wrong for me in a way that I should respect? Perhaps most importantly, though, I remind myself to choose the bigger life. Of course, what qualifies as the bigger life is different for everyone, but whenever I frame a choice in this way, it always helps me see the right answer loud and clear. And for you, it sounds like the bigger life might mean starting your own business. So good luck. Our next article by Ashley Mateo is titled, How to Move On from a Best Friend Breakup. Breaking up with a best friend can feel worse than splitting up with your partner. At least after a tryst ends, you've got your confidant to turn to. And while everyone acknowledges the trauma of romantic breakups, people don't really talk about the fallout of a platonic separation. But your brain doesn't know the difference between a romantic or platonic relationship. A breakup is a breakup. There was intimacy and trust, and then there wasn't. And it takes time to deal with the devastation of losing someone you always thought you'd have by your side. Surviving a best friend breakup isn't easy, but here's how to start the process. Acknowledge what happened and allow yourself time to grieve. Sometimes we underestimate the power of platonic relationships, says Danny Moy, PhD, a marriage and family therapist. But you expect to share the future with your close friends. And when that expectation disappears, it can be disorienting and disappointing. Take the time to reflect on what this shift means to you and sit with the discomfort of sadness, says Moy. When we don't grieve the relational losses we've endured, it may take us longer to move on. Know that not all friendships are meant to be forever. We use the phrase best friends forever because in the best of times, we expect that person to always be around. But the reality is we are attracted to and connect with people during particular times in our lives, says Dina M. DiNardo, PsyD, a marriage and family therapist. If we're doing our best to live consciously and to grow, we have to recognize that that means we might not always grow alongside someone or in the same direction as someone. What originally brought us together isn't necessarily the thing that will hold us together. That doesn't belittle or negate your friendship in any way, but if your relationship doesn't evolve, that's okay. And accepting that is crucial to finding closure. Don't forget the good parts. When a friendship ends, you might look back and question the entire relationship, wondering where you went wrong. We replay time and time again what transpired and how we would do things differently, says Moy, when we should be focusing on how that relationship fulfilled us while it lasted and what you learned from it. By simply shifting the way that you look at the breakup, it becomes easier to move on from a place of gratitude, she adds. Accept that there's no such thing as getting over it or moving on. When a relationship ends, it's understandable to shove those emotions about that person in a box and never let them bother you again. But while it's not nearly as recognized as death, divorce, and diagnosis, the loss of a dear friend is very painful and leaves a hole in your life that can never be filled in the same way, says Shelby Forsythia, a certified grief recovery specialist. There will be moments going forward, like weddings, anniversaries, and hard times, where you'll probably miss having that friend to lean on, and that's perfectly normal. The idea of moving on doesn't mean erasing this person's memory from your life. Appreciate the support system you still have. You're going through something hard, and the kick in the face aspect of it is that you don't even have your best friend to discuss it with. That doesn't mean you don't have support. Relationships are just as unique as people are, and one friendship cannot be swapped for another, says Forsythia. That being said, there are people in your life, your spouse, your family, your coworkers, that might be able to bolster you and support you in navigating this new life without your friend. But you have to reach out to them and let them know you need them. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Hiding your feelings is a surefire way to A, let them fester, and B, isolate yourself from the people who could help you cope. Whether it's with other friends, your family, or your therapist, it's important to talk it out to understand how you feel, what went wrong, what each person's responsibility was to the ending, and to receive honest feedback from people who know you well and truly care about you, said DiNardo. Be realistic about your role in it. You know the old adage, it takes two to tango. It's a cliche because it's so dead on. A breakup is rarely ever just one person's fault, but it's easier to be angry with the other person than to feel any of the things that might come up if we have to realistically look at our own self, says DiNardo. But you won't get the closure you need if you don't acknowledge the part you may have played in the breakup. Seeing your role brings you one step closer to finding peace in your heart as you continue along the journey of learning about what you've been, who you are, and who you want to be in the future, she says. Set boundaries for yourself. This is a kind of self-care and may be as simple as unfollowing your former friend on Instagram or blocking them on Facebook so you're not still getting a window into their life. Take an inventory of all of the ways and places they're bound to pop up and figure out where you need to step back or disconnect to keep your boundaries and heart safe, says Forsythia. These boundaries can change over time as things feel less raw, but there's nothing wrong with protecting yourself from triggers that will disrupt the progress you're trying to make in moving on. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled, Little Known Black History Facts You May Not Have Learned in School. From the hidden figures that made an impact, essential black inventors, change-making civil rights leaders, award-winning authors, and show-stopping 21st century women, Black history is rich in America. Resources like blackpast.org, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and the Library of Congress are great ways to expand on your knowledge as well as learn little-known Black history facts to further your understanding of African American culture. We've gathered a few choice bits of trivia spanning various topics that will inspire you to take your research beyond Black History Month. Literature. Number 1. Phyllis Wheatley was the first African-American to publish a book of poetry, poems on various subjects, religious and moral, in 1773. Born in Gambia and sold to the Wheatley family in Boston when she was 7 years old, Wheatley was emancipated shortly after her book was released. Number 2. Barr's Fight, written by poet and activist Lucy Terry in 1746, was the first known poem written by a black American. Terry was enslaved in Rhode Island as a toddler, but became free at age 26 after marrying a free black man. Number 3, Clotel, or The President's Daughter, was the first novel published by an African American in 1853. It was written by abolitionist and lecturer William Wells Brown. Important figures. Number 1. In case you didn't already know, the creator of Black History Month was historian Carter G. Woodson. Often referred to as the father of Black history, he was notably the second African American to graduate from Harvard University with a doctorate degree, and is credited with being one of the first scholars to study and research the history of African Americans. Number 2. William Tucker was the first known Black person to be born in the 13 colonies. He was born in Jamestown, Virginia in 1624. According to blackpast.org, his parents were indentured servants and part of the first group of Africans brought to colonial soil by Great Britain. Number 3. After years of remarkable work as an attorney, Thurgood Marshall became the first African American to serve in the U.S. Supreme Court. Officially nominated by President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1967, he served as a justice until 1991. Number 4. In 1854, John Mercer Langston notably became the first African-American lawyer in the state of Ohio. He went on to serve as the dean of the law department and vice president of Howard University. He's also remembered as the first African American from Virginia to be elected to public office, specifically to the U.S. Congress. Number 5, Anthony Benezet, a white Quaker, abolitionist, and educator, is credited with creating the first public school for African American children in the early 1770s. Number 6, after graduating from Oberlin College in 1850 with a literary degree, Lucy Stanton became the first black woman in America to earn a 4-year college degree. Music and television. Number 1. Dubbed hip-hop's first godmother by Billboard, singer and music producer Sylvia Robinson produced the first ever commercially successful rap record, Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And along with her husband, she co-owned the first hip-hop label, Sugar Hill Records. Number 2, renowned singer and jazz pianist Nat King Cole was the first black American to host a TV show, NBC's The Nat King Cole Show. Number 3, Stevie Wonder is not only the first black artist to win a Grammy for Album of the Year for 1973's Inner Visions, but the first and only musician to win Album of the Year with 3 consecutive studio albums. Number 4, in 1981, broadcast journalist Bryant Gumbel became the first black person to host a network morning show when he joined NBC's Today Show. Number 5, in 1940, Hattie McDaniel became the first black person to win an Oscar for her supporting role in Gone with the Wind. 24 years later, Sidney Poitier became the first black man to win an Oscar for his leading role in Lilies of the Field. Inventors. Number 1, Madam C.J. Walker created a line of hair care products for African-American women, leading her to later become the first female African-American self-made millionaire. Number 2, computer scientist Lisa Galopter assisted with the 1995 creation of Shockwave, essential technology that led to the development of web animation. So we have her to thank for GIFs. Number 3, agricultural scientist George Carver was responsible for creating over 500 new products made from peanuts and sweet potatoes, including cooking oils, paint, and soap. Sports. Number 1, in 1908, after winning the 4x400-meter relay, John Taylor became the first African-American to win gold in the Olympics. And in 1948, Alice Coachman became the first black woman in the world to win an Olympic gold medal while competing in the high jump. Number 2, founded in 1984, the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo is the only touring African-American rodeo in the world. Number 3, in 1920, Fritz Pollard and Bobby Marshall became the first black athletes to play in the NFL. Pollard was also the league's first black coach. Number 4, in 2012, at the London Olympics, Gabby Douglas became the first black gymnast to win the individual all-around title. Number 5, in 1996, Cheryl Swoopes became the first player to sign with the WNBA, with the league debuting a year later. Society and life. Number 1, first published in 1936, Negro Motorist Green Book was a comprehensive guide for black travelers about locations across America and eventually overseas that were either black owned or didn't engage in segregationist practices. The guide was printed for 30 years. It stopped publication in 1966, 2 years after the Civil Rights Act was passed. Number 2, the oldest black female Greek letter organization, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Inc., or AKA, was founded at Howard University in 1908. Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Inc., or Alpha, the first black male Greek letter organization, was founded in 1906 at Cornell University. Number 3, it's estimated that around 100,000 enslaved people escaped to the North via the Underground Railroad from 1810 to 1850. Number 4, in July 1777, Vermont became the first colony to ban slavery. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is titled, What It Means to Dream That Your Hair Is on Fire. I dreamed that the ends of my hair were on fire. I was thinking in the dream, oh my God, my hair is on fire. I was hitting the small blaze trying to snuff out the fire. My sister was there and she wasn't concerned at all. She was saying, "It's fine, no big deal." I think other family members were there as well. Then the following night, I dreamed that my left eyelashes were coming out. As I looked in the mirror to see one eye with huge gaps where lashes should be, I asked myself, "What did you do?" Signed, "My hair's on fire." Dear, my hair's on fire. A dream is a discussion you have with yourself concerning a recent waking situation. If you were trying to work something through yesterday, you may very well continue working it through today. Analyzing your dreams over a period of a few days not only can reveal an extended issue occupying your mind, but can actually show your inner movement and growth as it happens. In other words, these two dreams together present a great opportunity to explore an ongoing conversation that your unconscious mind is offering to you. Reading the first dream, it strikes me that it's terrible to have your hair on fire, but it's even worse when your own sister and family members think that it's no big deal. That's where I'd begin. Is there a recent situation in your life in which you feel panic and are also in need of immediate help, yet your concerns are being minimized? Or more than just minimized? Your obvious urgent need for help is gathering zero attention or action? Ask yourself, is there a recent situation in which I am feeling completely unsupported? As part of this interpretation, I want to call your attention to the play on words you seem to have used in saying, "My hair's on fire." The Urban Dictionary describes this expression as a phrase to say when you're on a strict deadline, a way to express being extremely busy or to convey a sense of urgency. Here's another thought. Suppose you can identify a situation where you have a sense of urgency that you believe others are ignoring. Could this dream be pointing you toward an underlying feeling that the others might be right? This could depend on your feelings about your sister. Would you describe her as someone who is calm in an emergency and makes effective decisions under pressure? Do you normally trust her judgment? If your answer to these questions is yes, your sister might contain the solution to the problem. Maybe you need to lean into her qualities to resolve your current situation. You might even consider whether you should move closer to your sister's attitude in this dream. Could your current dilemma be resolved by deciding to relax a little? Is it possible that, as she says in the dream, your situation is not a big deal? Maybe my description strikes a chord, or maybe it strikes you as wrong. So take a moment to think about your sister. Her role in your solution will depend on how you feel about her. Let's turn to the second dream, where you have huge gaps in the lashes around one eye. Following the assumption that the two dreams are connected, this dream continues the ideas presented in the first dream, where your family doesn't see the urgency of your situation. The huge gaps around your eye in the second dream suggest there might be huge gaps in how you were seeing something. You end this dream by asking yourself, "What did I do?" Here you are acknowledging some responsibility for your own situation. You seem to be moving toward a position where you are ready to look beyond how others aren't helping you and instead examine what part you are playing in your circumstances. Whenever we focus on our own responsibility, we tend to reduce the blame on others and start taking care of the business at hand. I ask you to consider two possibilities for your business at hand. Have you asked for help in the situation that is stressing you? If not, then don't feel disappointed at others' lack of concern, but turn toward those who love you and express what you need. The other possibility is to accept your share of responsibility, as you were already suggesting in the second dream, where you ask what you have done to help create your current situation. Finding the answer to this question will require seeing the matter clearly, with no gaps, and with both your eyes. Wondering what that crazy dream you had could possibly mean? Don't let it keep you up at night. Our in-house dream analyst, Lane Dalfin, author of the Have a Great Dream books, is here to help you make sense of it all. In a column for Oprah Daily, Lane draws upon her decades of experience to explore what a reader's dream is trying to tell them. You can learn more about Lane's work on her website or by following her on Instagram. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled, "Uplifting Things to Do Alone at Home When You Can't Take the Boredom." Chances are, if you're like most people, you enjoy a little alone time. And by the way, that's not a bad thing. In fact, research shows it can be beneficial. In addition to giving you the chance to unwind and actually rest, it can also boost creativity and productivity and improve your overall happiness. Not to mention that it can also enhance your relationships with friends, family members, and colleagues. Just take it from Oprah, who in a 2005 What I Know For Sure column said, "Alone time is when I recharge and go back to my center, distancing myself from the voices of the world so I can hear my own with clarity." Of course, though, that doesn't mean spending more time alone is effortless. There's the question of, what are some fun things to do by yourself? And inevitably, what should I do when I become bored? Which is exactly why we've compiled a list of things to do alone at home, many of which can also be done outside when the weather is nice. You can try to meditate or step up your fitness routine. You can make a dent in your to-be-read pile or finally catch up on your favorite Netflix shows. You can learn a new skill like cooking or gardening. You can even spend a night or weekend catching up on sleep. The best part? Getting started is easy because all you need is yourself. Number one, fire up a workout app. If you aren't able to go to the gym, there are plenty of ways to shake up your workout routine from the comfort of your home. Number two, let a celebrity read you a bedtime story. You don't have to be a kid to enjoy the soothing voices of Oprah, Betty White, and Chrissy Metz reading children's books. Storyline Online's YouTube channel features 62 different clips. Number three, learn a new language. It's never too late to pick up a new language, and there are a multitude of apps that can teach you from home. One of our favorites, Duolingo. Number four, take an online class. Skillshare has plenty of creative and interactive online classes, or try masterclass.com, where celebs like Gordon Ramsay and RuPaul offer lessons. Number five, DIY some spa treatments. Treat yourself to some at-home relaxation with a little TLC. Try giving yourself a luxury facial or use a pre-made mask. Number six, make yourself a cocktail. Have a party of one and master a new boozy beverage. With practice, you'll impress the next time you meet up with friends or gather for a virtual happy hour. Number seven, engage in solo karaoke. Try an app like Smule, which lets you sing like karaoke with folks around the world, complete with audio effects and visual features. You can also join your friends for a house party where you're all, of course, welcome to sing. Number eight, do a paint-by-number kit. If a blank canvas intimidates you, consider a paint-by-number kit or an adult coloring book, which can act as a great stress reliever. Number nine, try a YouTube beauty tutorial. If you've been meaning to play around with that new eyeshadow palette or trying to figure out how to style those curls or get beach waves, YouTube is full of inspiring and simple tutorials that will keep you busy. Really feeling adventurous? Maybe film one yourself. Number 10, meditate. Slow down, breathe, and clear your mind with whatever form of meditation works best for you. Whether you practice early in the morning before your day starts or at night. Number 11, learn some old school choreography. Next time you're alone, blast a happy playlist as loud as you please and really feel the music. Or learn some new moves. Cue up a YouTube tutorial to get a step-by-step guide to the single ladies choreo, for instance. Number 12, look at family photos. Are most of your pics stored on your phone? Consider uploading them to a site like Shutterfly to create an album, or better yet, a customized puzzle. Number 13, garden. Use Oprah's illustrious bounty as inspiration to test your green thumb. You can check out the gardening guide for beginners on the Oprah.com website. Number 14, find a new show to binge. Looking for a glossy escape? There's Bling Empire on Netflix, or if you haven't given the hit period drama Bridgerton a chance yet, we suggest you stop reading now and go press play. Number 15, rearrange your bookshelf. Whether you color coordinate your library, a trendy option right now, or organize based on a genre, this will help you remember which reads are worth revisiting.
Number 16, finally tackle the clutter. Channel your inner Marie Kondo and tackle any problem spot in your home that doesn't spark joy. Whether it's a garage, overstuffed dresser, or a messy closet, it'll feel amazing to dig into spring cleaning. Number 17, knit something warm and fuzzy. According to Mental Health America, knitting not only results in some pretty comfy scarves and sweaters, but it can also help reduce anxiety and lower blood pressure. Number 18, write in your journal. Jotting down your thoughts can help you sort through your feelings and will serve as a fun time capsule to revisit the next time you're alone. Number 19, catch up on sleep. Indulge in the time-honored tradition of listening to a soothing story podcast and let a nurturing voice lull you to sleep. Number 20, indulge in a little self-love. Yes, we're talking masturbation. The act is known to reduce stress, help with mental clarity, and even improve communication with your partner. Number 21, take a soothing bath. Not only is a lengthy warm soak just naturally relaxing, but if you use the right bubble bath and essential oils, it may also help soothe your skin. Number 22, watch the sunrise or sunset. Though it happens every day, it's easy to take the wonder of a beautiful sunrise or sunset for granted. Whenever you have the time, find the perfect perch that will allow you to take in and appreciate the colorful sight. Number 23, disconnect from the tech. Close the laptop or even shut down your phone for an hour. Challenge yourself to unplug and stay away from screens for an allotted amount of time and see what happens. Studies suggest that decreasing screen time can help your sleep improve and increase your productivity. Number 24, find a new page turner. Browse your Kindle's virtual library or Barnes & Noble's digital vault. And if you need any recommendations, we may be pretty biased, but Oprah's Book Club is a pretty swell place to start.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.